This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is another online-only edition of Booktown. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm putting this program together on Monday, the 17th of July, 2006, with some material that has appeared on KVMR and some that it has not. In this program, I'll be talking with two women who will be appearing in Nevada County in the next week. First, with novelist Elizabeth Rosner, who will be presenting her latest work, Blue Nude, at the Bookseller in Grass Valley this Thursday, the 20th, at 6:30 p.m. I talked to her last week. Let's see if I've got this right. In your novel, Blue Nude, there's a somewhat hostile, somewhat repressed, middle-aged, I guess 58-year-old painter, German painter named Danzig, who's teaching at the Art Institute in San Francisco. He's been very successful in the past, but he hasn't been able to paint anything for many years, over 5 years. Mm-hmm. In one of his drawing classes, there's a new model named Merav, who is Israeli. He is suddenly infatuated with her, but he realizes that he has been infatuated with models in the past with disastrous results. Nonetheless, he asks her to model for her. She agrees. There are flashbacks to both of their horrible pasts. His, as a child growing up just after World War II, the son of a rather brutal ex-Nazi whose older sister has killed herself. And she has grown up in Israel as a aspiring painter, a reluctant soldier, and she has seen her best friend blown up by a terrorist bomb. They've both gone to California to sort of find a new life. They're both very hesitant. In the end, she does go to his studio, she models for him, and he comes back to life. Is that a fair resume?
That's an excellent summary, yes.
And the way it's told is almost like what would go on in one of the modeling classes, where a model will hold a posture for a couple of minutes and then move to a new one, and we see each of their stories from one angle after another until it's almost like a series of sketches, I mm-hmm. guess you could say. Mm-hmm. Was that deliberate?
Yeah, I was thinking about, on some level anyway, thinking about it. There's a lot that's unconscious about the writing process for me too, but I had this awareness of approaching this story as if it were a painting being assembled layer by layer.
And actually, that's the way it's mentioned several times in there. That's the way that Danzig would work.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentions that that's the way some other people like Velázquez and I think Bernard would also.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the layers are built up and sometimes they're scraped away.
But the result, I assume that you have some experience with painting. You've done it yourself?
I have done some. I have to admit that I don't feel particularly talented in that realm, but I was fascinated by the process and wanted to experiment with being inside the view and physical body of a painter and understand that character from the inside. I really am intrigued by what goes on in a painter's mind and body while working both with and without a model being present. What are the things that get in the way? What are the things that assist in the inspiration?
And Danzig was a pretty much obsessive artist. He had known from
very young age, I guess when he was 6 or 7, he started carrying a little notebook around and drawing things. His father hated this idea, tried to keep him away, so he wound up studying, going to art classes in secret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot of pressure on him in many ways to conform to his father's expectations, and of course those had to do with what had gone on during the war before Danzig was even born, and his father's participation in the Nazi power structure, and with all sorts of ideas about right and wrong and purity and impurity, and that included a view of art as something degenerate and undesirable. So Danzig's experience in his family was that he had to hide that part of himself.
And eventually he had to flee, and he never really responded to his friends in Germany who tried to get in touch with him. He cut himself off almost completely from his
past. Yeah, I think art for him began as a kind of escapism even when he was a child, a way of seeing the world through his own eyes, not through the eyes of his parents. And ultimately for him that meant leaving it all behind and rejecting entirely his past. But of course, as we all know, you can run but you can't hide, and his past follows him in the same way that it would follow any of us.
And Mirav had a somewhat similar background in some ways, in that she had an idyllic childhood on a kibbutz with a single mother but with very good friends. Mm-hmm. Then, though, she found herself in the Israeli army and realized that she could not bring herself to shoot or kill someone.
Yeah, for me it was really a desire to explore the possibility of growing up in a culture in which you had no choice but to participate in the military. It's compulsory military service in Israel, and yet what happens if you really, I mean, she doesn't go so far as to attempt to be a conscientious objector, and I believe that in Israel you really have to claim a very strong religious belief system in order to make that assertion about yourself and avoid military service. So she does fulfill her duty, but with great inner resistance to the idea of treating everyone as an enemy and being willing to kill in the name of her country's defense.
In America, she doesn't have that problem, but she does. She's still very defensive.
Yeah, again, I think, I often have imagined, because both of my parents left their countries of origin, they were Holocaust survivors and went sort of both voluntarily and involuntarily into exile after the war. I've often tried to imagine what that really is like, to give up your homeland, to give up your language, to try and reinvent yourself in a new country. What does that take in terms of a deliberate choice to leave everything behind, and what does it take in terms of optimism and faith and a belief in the possibilities of the future to start over somewhere new? And so I see both of these characters not only as coming all the way to a new country, but locating themselves all the way in California as if to get as far as possible from their countries of origin and to be on the West Coast, in the place where even Americans often go to reinvent themselves.
And in Mirav's case, going from the desert to the redwoods.
Right, from complete dryness to the lush moisture of a soaked, foggy landscape.
Now, you have been an American, you're American born, but your parents, as you said, are Holocaust survivors.
Correct.
How have I assume you've been in both Germany and Israel?
Yes.
How do those countries strike you with your past?
Well, I haven't been to either place in quite a long time. Long before I started writing this book, I spent time in those countries. And I have family in Israel. I have quite a number of cousins and extended family living there, starting with my father's brother, who both my father and my uncle together were in a concentration camp in Germany. And my uncle ended up in Israel, and my father ended up in America. But I went there partly to see if I could connect with family and mostly to experience life on a kibbutz. I was really fascinated by that idea of communal living and what it might mean in terms of how children were raised and what family life would be like and what your relationship to the land might be. So I spent a few months living on a kibbutz, but, you know, I was an outsider. I did speak Hebrew, and I'm Jewish, and I had a lot of feelings of connection, but I can't really say I truly understood what it was like to live on the kibbutz. So a lot of that was my imagining my way into someone who had grown up in that life.
Your first novel, The Speed of Light, you actually released a novel and a book of poems at the same time that sort of complemented one another.
Yeah, I call my poetry collection the autobiographical companion to my novels, and that still turns out to be true for Blue Nude as well, even though Gravity came out quite a long time ago now. But I do feel that my interest in my family history is both a process of going backwards and a process of looking inwards for me. And my relationship to Germany and my father's German background, my father was born in Hamburg and my mother was born in Vilna, Lithuania. And unfortunately, I haven't spent any time in my mother's place of birth. But going to Germany once alone and once with my father was a process of trying to uncover some of the silent places or the secret places that hadn't really been spoken about in the family. My first novel was very much an exploration of the places where the stories aren't told and can't be spoken. But a lot of my exploration, even in the second novel, is about how the past we inherit shapes us, and yet what are the choices we get to make about our lives now? What do we get to accept and reject about what we're given? How do we transform that into a life that feels meaningful on its own?
One of the major, I guess it's a symbol, one of the major objects in the novel is a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bathtub in the ruined building that the young Danzig goes by and sketches and just immerses himself in.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bathtub that led to his sister's death, and then there's a bathtub at the very in his studio and
right.
at the very end.
Right.
And what does that mean?
Well, for me, water is one of those elements that really literally runs through the work. And you even used the word immersion a little while ago, the idea of water being a place where we, in some ways, go to cleanse ourselves, to purify ourselves, to remove those outer layers of what might be dirt or stains or just the experience of being exposed to life. And so water can be this place of renewal, and yet it can also be a place for losing yourself, for disappearing, for going under. And I like to work with it on all of those levels, and water's been very present element in my own life. I've often gone for solace to the water and for comfort and some kind of healing.
And at the end, Merav has a posture in the bathtub that is similar to Danzig's older sister when she died.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not commented on.
Well, you know, it's one of those subtleties that you hope readers will experience on an almost visceral level that, you know, sometimes I find that readers tell me what the symbols in my books are and
mm-hmm.
not the other way around. And I confess that I often prefer it that way, that I said a little while ago about some of my process being very unconscious. And there are times when those images that recur are happening just below my awareness, and they're there because in some ways the characters guide them or the images themselves are running things, and I'm less and less in control from the creator point of view, which I like.
And do you consider that a more poetic than a prose approach to writing?
You know, I've come to question that whole distinction, I guess, between prose and poetry over time. The poetry I write tends to be quite prosaic, and the prose I write is rather poetic, and I guess I think I'm working in some blurry zone between those two forms. But I think the qualities that we look for in poetry, the qualities of intense imagery and compression of language, economy of language, where less is more, where sometimes the spaces in between what is being said are as important as the words themselves, those qualities I like to see in my fiction as well, in my novels. And yet I want them to be read as stories that have a compelling line pulling the reader forward, too.
Although the plot, there's definitely tension leading to a climax in this novel, but it's not plot-driven in any way.
Right. I think my writing always seems to emerge first from a sense of character and my curiosity about all the depths that a character can reveal over time. And so what's pulling my stories forward, I think, is that slow unveiling of character, both a character's awareness of him or herself, character's awarenesses of one another, and then my awareness and the reader's awareness of who they are. So the stories are really more about the psychological uncovering than things that happen.
The Speed of Light had to do with a Holocaust survivor and his children. Mm-hmm. Was that more autobiographical?
Well, yes and no. I have said that both of my books are really emotionally autobiographical as opposed to factually. The family in The Speed of Light, the brother and sister whose father was an Auschwitz survivor, in some ways the brother and sister are both parts of me. So neither one is me, and the brother isn't my brother, and so on. But they're really parts of myself I wanted to explore, the part of me that really learned an inheritance of grief and trauma. How did that move me through the world? And then the part of me that knew how to go out into the world singing. So the brother is very introverted, the sister is very extroverted. Those are both parts of my own personality. And in Blue Nude, in some ways I was wandering through the territory of how did I take those stories I was given and those inherited emotions and turn them into a creative life? How did I try and transform those inheritances into art?
Though in this case, it's really the actor and the person who is acted upon or acted from, almost like the introvert and extrovert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I like that play back and forth between character. I mean, in Speed of Light, I was using, there's a third major character in Speed of Light who's from Central America, who's a witness to a massacre there. And I wanted to use all three of their perspectives to tell the story. In Blue Nude, I'm moving back and forth between points of view also, just not quite as rapidly as I did in Speed of Light.
And it's the actual action takes place in only a few days.
Right. I really liked the idea of a frame in the present that was a very small space of time, and then the backstory occupying a big period, a few decades.
Now, you've been writing, I imagine, for most of your life, at mm-hmm. least most of your adult life. Mm-hmm. You've taught writing for many years.
Yeah.
But you've actually only been publishing in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
Was this something that you felt you really had to have a long germination period to get these ideas out, or did you write novels you were dissatisfied with?
Well, I have the proverbial novel in the closet that will never see the light of day. There's that one.
Is that an early work?
Yes, an early mediocre work. I think of it as my practice novel. I learned a lot from writing it, and I also learned a lot from letting go of it. But I think for me, my writing process has really needed to evolve over time. Not only the content, the stories themselves getting clearer and clearer and the characters getting clearer and clearer, but my own sensibility about how I work and how I get to the place where the language can actually come out of me onto the page. It's not a very rapid process, I'm sorry to say, for me. I wish I had a little bit more fluidity. And yet what I have is this period of, you know, I'll have a period of great intensity where a lot will sort of just come pouring out of me, and then everything will get quiet, and I'll go silent for a long time, and I'll kind of panic and think, oh my God, it's over, it's done, I can't finish this, and then things will start up again. So when people ask me what my discipline is or what my method is, it's a bit bumpy, it's quite erratic. And so sometimes that means long stretches of time where progress is being made at some subterranean level that I'm almost unaware of.
Do you ever get the situation like Danzig where you just stare at a canvas, or in your case a piece of paper, and do nothing for day after day?
Yeah, his relationship with those blank canvases is very much a relationship I have with the blank page at times, where it's almost a form of meditation, of staring into staring into that white space and just waiting, sometimes patiently and more often impatiently. But his fear and despair and anxiety and worry are very much reflective of mine, and the, one of the themes that runs through the novel too, the theme of begin again was very much an echo in my head as I was working on this book. As my second novel, I was under contract for it, and knowing that there were people expecting something from me, waiting for something from me, and that I had to keep reminding myself that it was okay to start over, and that I would just have to trust that this book would come into being.
So there's another painter in the book on the kibbutz, Tzvi, mm-hmm. who has a similar process but seems to take it much more genially. He will stare at a finished or almost finished canvas maybe for days and days and days, and then decide to add something.
Yeah, well, I've interviewed a number of painters and spent time in studios with painters, and I'm always fascinated by the different ways people handle those silences or those spaces where the work just needs to rest or unfold at a slower pace. And there certainly is a range of attitudes people have toward that and how they manage those in-between times. And I think it can be a reflection of one's level of optimism or pessimism in the world. Do you kind of trust that everything's going to be okay, or do you always fear that a catastrophe is about to happen? And I think with someone like Danzig, who grew up in a kind of violent, tumultuous household where moods weren't predictable and the kind of the emotional weather wasn't predictable, you maybe aren't as sanguine about what's going to happen next. And I have some of that in me, too. Again, part of my legacy of being the daughter of Holocaust survivors.
That was novelist Elizabeth Rosner, author most recently of Blue Nude, which she'll be presenting this Thursday evening at 6:30 p.m. at the bookseller in Grass Valley. This is the online-only version of Booktown. I'm Eric Thome, and I'm assembling this program on Monday, the 17th of July, 2006. I also talked this week with Susan Klein, not KVMR Susan Klein, but the storyteller from Martha's Vineyard, who has come several times to the Sierra Storytelling Festival and will be back again this weekend. Here's some of what we talked about.
Susan, what makes a good storyteller?
Well, I think probably we ought to use the word effective rather than good, if that's okay with you.
It's okay with me.
All righty. Well, to be an effective storyteller, you need to be in service to a great number of things and people. And it's a list, and you need to be in service to the art form. You need to be in service to the story. You need to be in service to the audience. You need to be in service to your own sense of journey, your journey of self. And you also need to be, if you happen to be doing it professionally, you need to be in service to your sponsors and producers. So it's it really is a service industry, and you need to be able to stick with it. it's not an easy road to hoe. A lot of people think it looks kind of glamorous and that it's a sweet way to go through life. And well, in fact, that's true. It is, but it doesn't come without its sacrifices. You know.
But when you are up on the platform and telling your story, I imagine that's where it's when it all comes together.
Well, that's what everyone hopes at all times. So it's an interesting thing that because if you do believe in all of those things and you do practice all of those things, then in fact the only thing it can do is come together because you've done the right thing and everything's on your side, you know, and it does work. So it doesn't matter what genre you work in, and it doesn't matter anything else. It's a great responsibility that one takes on, though, if you're going to be a storyteller and you're going to be the voice for thoughts and values and events throughout history and throughout the third eye, you know, which is a pretty large place.
You say throughout history, and I guess that many of your stories come from your personal experience, but quite a few come from the tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do a lot of different kinds of things. And the things that come from my own life, you know, they're distillations of a life that's pretty well lived at this point, and it's been a good run so far, which is pretty sweet. But I grew up on Martha's Vineyard, and so I do a lot of stories that come from here, and that are also in my book Through a Ruby Window that came out about 10 years ago. And that's about growing up on the vineyard in the 50s and the 60s when we were actually a hunting and gathering community at that time, which of course the television tells you different now, but it before we were discovered, it really was the kind of place where we had game and shellfish and fish probably five nights a week, certainly 3 to 5 nights a week every week. Hamburger was a big deal if it came from the store, you know.
Mm-hmm.
we didn't do a lot of that. And, you know, we gathered all kinds of things, you know, the regular berries and stuff like that. Everybody grew grapes because they grew wild here, and so everybody had grapes. And there was just a lot of connection to the island, and it being a source of many things, that not only its beauty, but also it fed us, you know, in other ways.
And it's not that way now.
Well, we don't hunt as much as we did because there's more houses than there used to be, and the traditional places where people hunted are getting narrower. There had to be a moratorium put on some of the fishing because they were overfished later on, but those moratoriums are lifting, and there's just a different culture here now. It just is.
And another area you draw a lot of your stories from is the backcountry of Alaska. Is that because it reminded you of the sort of society you grew up in?
Well, no, I actually toured there as a storyteller, an itinerant, and I worked in the Alaskan bush with the Yupik Eskimo people. I went from village to village there one winter, and then I worked a couple of times in the logging camps and a couple of times with the Tlingit people in the Panhandle. And so some of the stories come from those experiences, which were pretty challenging, to say the least. So and uproarious quite often, you know. It's always those stories of a stranger in a strange land, you know, trying to learn the ways is always makes for good story fodder, you know.
Now, those are societies where storytelling had been a central part of the
still
culture.
Is.
It
yeah,
still is. So, did you learn things from them about storytelling?
Well, one of the groups that I worked with, people own stories, and so there's not a free transmission of those between families, or certainly not for outsiders. And then with the other folks, their format is so different than what my format is that so I was on a steep learning curve there, but I don't tell any of those stories at all.
Okay, and did they learn anything from you?
One hopes that there was definitely transmission back and forth. You know, the I told stories quite a bit while I was there, and it was fascinating. I certainly learned a lot about their culture, and speaking specifically about the Eskimos because I was with them the longest, and it's a fascinating place. It's a place where the wheel never needed to be invented because everything either slid on the ice or floated on the water, and still does, actually.
When you went up there, did you tell stories of Martha's Vineyard or from your larger repertoire?
I told mostly folklore and fairy tale and myth, specifically because that's the kind of stories that they have in their own culture, and those are the ones that they transmit from one to another and down through the generations. So it was the genre that they were familiar with.
When you go to a storytelling festival, do you know in advance which stories you're going to tell?
Never.
But do you know an hour before you go up on stage or 5 minutes before?
I don't. Some people have planned it all out. The only time I ever know what I'm going to tell when I get up there is if a sponsor or an audience member has asked me specifically to tell something. And even then, I usually say I will do it if it fits in the space and if it's the right thing. I don't ever commit because... Well, actually, I work in a different kind of style, and that style is that I listen to the kinds of information that's being given to me, and it doesn't necessarily come in the normal channels. So quite often I get an image in my mind as I walk up the stairs to the stage, or sometimes during the storyteller who is previous to me, if we're in an oleo kind of situation, you know, sort of like a round robin kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a number of us on stage together, then sometimes during that time something comes up, and I just, you know, I just know that I have to serve that. I have to serve those decisions because it's not pretty if you ignore the muse, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't like it. So, the thing that is helpful is that I've been blessed with the ability to know that if I have a 15-minute slot, that a 35-minute story is not going to make itself known. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't happen. At least they're taking care of me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the repertoire is large enough so that those kinds of decisions can be made pretty easily. And so I just respect whatever's coming through and serve it.
And when you go up, if you get the impulse to, say, tell story A, do you tell it the way you might have told it 3 weeks before, or is it always more free form?
It's always free form to an extent. All of the stories are in there. They're not memorized. But the beginning, middle, and end, the conflict, the resolution, the character development, the plot, the sense of place, all of those things are intact. But the words that I choose are not necessarily the same.
Now, how did you get into this?
Well, somebody called me up and in the 70s and said, you need to come down to the school and take a look at this guy tonight. He's going to tell some stories. And I thought, no, I don't think so. I have a good book. Maybe I'll just stay home. And she said, no, you talk story all the time. You need to come see this. And I said, you know, I really don't think so. And she said, yeah, you're going. So I went down there, not quite understanding what it meant to be a storyteller for adults. It was an adult performance that night, and it didn't take but 35 seconds or so before I realized that she was absolutely right, though I didn't, of course, didn't want to admit that, but that, in fact, I was absolutely mesmerized, and I knew that there was an imminent career change at that point. There was no question.
What had you been doing before?
I was a school teacher, and I had been an actress, and my early degree was in theater arts and education, and my later one was in education, my master's. And so, you know, I'd certainly been all set up to be a researcher, you know, a scholar, but, and then all the stuff, you know, it doesn't matter who you become in life, everything you do actually serves that eventually, and it all comes into play. So, of course, I do a lot of research and all of that now, and surely all my theater background comes in handy for taking the stage.
Who was the storyteller? Who?
It was Jay O'Callaghan.
Mm-hmm.
Who is a magnificent storyteller.
And once that happened, you decided you had to hear more or you had to start doing it yourself?
Well, I immediately started doing it myself. And I started building a repertoire. And I took a class, actually, at that time. I was still getting my master's then. And so I took a class with Jay. It was a weekend class. And I think there were 16 of us in there. And so I was the only one that went on to to do that. Everybody else was using the, you know, the different kinds of applications of storytelling in their work, and some were healers and some were educators. And some, I think somebody was in the ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I can see it working in all those fields.
Yeah, it really does.
And since you've gotten into it, I guess you're sort of the complete storyteller. You tell stories, you write books, you do workshops, you also do recording and production for other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, the last summer, Kaleidoscope came out, which is it's a collection of old stories with a new twist. By Peggy Hagen, who's out in New York, and so I worked with her for years on those stories until they were really well honed. And she's a fabulous interpreter of story. And so, Kaleidoscope came out last year and is doing well. It's a CD. And then just a few weeks ago, Lobstering with My Papa came out, which is was the first book that I've done for somebody else, and it's a full color hardback children's picture book, which. It's quite a beauty, actually, and the author and the illustrator from the island. And so it was wonderful to be the project director slash publisher slash editor slash I'm also the voice on the CD that accompanies it. I'm a voiceover artist as well. So it's a lovely project, and it's such a pretty book. And it's all about specifically about the ways in which a very solid family on the vineyard sends down all the values through the generations, and how they do that through word and deed. It's beautiful.
When you do a book like that, a book that's accompanied by a CD,
mm-hmm.
is the CD, is the material identical?
Identical, yeah.
So somebody can either read it or listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's tucked into the back of the book. But, you know, after having done so many audios, I mean, I've been producing audios for 20 years, and so... You know, at this point, as a production person, I have a whole cadre of professionals that work with me, and you know, it's just wonderful to have those kinds of people doing that kind of work and being able to collaborate over and over and over with the same people. It's lovely. And then every now and then, you have a new set of professionals that come in and new relationships within a project. It takes a lot of different people to create a book. So,
yeah, it's interesting. We've talked recently with some. Book producers in Nevada County, and I didn't realize how complicated the process was these days.
Yeah, it's crazy making. By the time you finish, you really, you've used up all of the left brain stuff for sure, you know. So, and once the right brain kicks in, does all the creative stuff, the left brain has to pick up all the slack. Boy, it's just a series of details upon details upon details. It's amazing.
So how much of your time do you spend doing things like that, and how much are you on the road?
There's absolutely no way to figure that out, because every month and every year is different. I've been on the road 24 years, and no 2 years have been the same. Sometimes I do a bunch of festivals. Sometimes I do a couple. Sometimes I'm involved in three or four audio projects, depending on what it is. You know, I did the anniversary double CD for the National Storytelling Festival that happened after when they celebrated 30 years. So I took 100 hours of live storytelling and distilled it down. Until I took out about 140 minutes, you know, that were whole stories, but there's only 140 minutes of stories that they did for a double CD, which is pretty standard. They run 72 minutes apiece, and that was interesting, you know, listening to 100 hours. Oh my goodness! Then another big project was the Historical Association, the Heritage Trail Association. In Somerset County in New Jersey, hired me in 1999 to tell the story of Hurricane Floyd. They hired me to tell the story of Hurricane Floyd when it stalled off of the coast, the Mid-Atlantic coast, and it just blasted New Jersey. And folklorically, they got between 12 and 15 inches of rain in 5 hours. The weather, well, I did a whole bunch of research with the weather people, and they say between 8 and 11, but who knows? It all ran downhill. There was plenty of water, you know. The Raritan River raised 42 and a half feet.
Wow.
And so it was a real precursor to everything that happened down in Louisiana but in Mississippi, but it was on a much smaller scale. There were only 5,000 people displaced, but 5,000 people is still 5,000 people, and it's an extraordinary story. So I researched for about a year and a half, went down to New Jersey a number of times and did live interviews, and then we taped them, and then I just, for months, just listened to the tapes over and over again. We had them all transcribed, and then it became an 85-minute one-woman show and a recording. So it's, there's a lot of different kinds. So that's contemporary history. The other stuff is, you know, the stuff I did for the National Association, the National Storytelling Network. That recording is autobiographical and poetic, and it's also has fairy tales and folklore and myth on it. So there's, you know, it's a real conglomerate. But so there's a lot of different kinds of things that happen out of this tiny little studio here.
Yeah, this coming weekend you're going to be at the 21st Sierra Storytelling Festival.
Yes,
you've been here. You've been here before.
4 or 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there as a storyteller 3 or 4 times, and as an MC, I've been there as well. So it's just a delight to come back.
Do different? I assume I know the answer to this, but I assume that different festivals have different feelings to them.
Always, yes. Well, they were, you know, regional, and they're very different. I was in a festival in Georgia, a wonderful festival in Roswell, Georgia, 2 weeks ago, and one thing that they will have that you don't have up there is about 100% humidity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. We were outside. It was hot, hot, hot. And we had this great thunderstorm right at the beginning of one of the evening shows. So that doesn't happen up in the Sierras. You get that thing that goes on in the Sierras, though, is something.
Well, the thunderstorms are higher up in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
They occur all summer, but we only get them down here maybe twice.
Yeah. Well, it's such a lovely sight, the Sierra Festival. I mean, you just feel so embraced by all of those trees there. And the community is the same. You know, I get to stay with the same folks over and over again when I go back, and that's really lovely. We don't see each other, you know, for years, and then we just pick up where we left off. It's just the best.
So you just come maybe every 4 or 5 years, something like that, 3 or 4
yes,
years?
Yes, you know, I honestly don't know the rate at which I've appeared there, but I guess it's probably around that.
And right now they are doing a major fixing up of the schoolhouse. Of course,
yes.
The festival is outside. It's not in the schoolhouse. But I think
it is. No.
Well, that's true. There are some sessions inside.
Yeah.
You're right. I usually go to the evening ones that are outside.
Mm-hmm.
Those are my favorites, but they do exist all over the property.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's going to be clean and sparkling. At least I think they hope it will be.
That's lovely. Sounds good to me. You know, a little renovation's a good thing. We can all use that, huh?
That was Susan Klein, who will be one of the featured storytellers at this year's Sierra Storytelling Festival. It'll take place from Friday to Sunday of this week, the 21st through the 23rd, at the North Columbia Schoolhouse Cultural Center. This has been an online version of Booktown. I'm Eric Tome, and I assembled this on Monday, the 17th of July, 2006. And I'll probably keep doing it as long as there are more interesting literary people to talk to than we have time for on the air.